We welcome the mayor of Columbia, Brian Treese, to our studios for conversation about city business now on KFRU's Columbia Morning. Mayor, good morning. How are you?
David, good morning.
We were just talking off the air, this city council meeting. Do you do what some of us in the media do and look at the agenda and say, well, let's see, if I'm going to rate this one on the excitement level of 1 to 10, with 10 being high, this might be a 3.
I get the agenda about the same time everybody else does, which is about 5 o'clock on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And I'll look at it and kind of do a quick pass through to anticipate any questions I might get from constituents or the media. And then I spend most of my Sunday evening going through and reading all the attachments and all the council memos.
So what did you read about last night?
Well, there's some interesting things there, but I think it's intentionally kept light because we're swearing in a new council member and saying goodbye to one of our more veteran members of council. And so as not to overwhelm the new guy, I think we'll have a pretty short evening.
I read of a couple of things, and I don't know whether they are big or not, but I'm curious about a couple of things. One was, I teased in my promo for today, if anybody knew where Moore's Lake was. Moore's Lake, you're making a decision today about restoration of that lake.
Yeah, I could probably tell you more about Moore's Lake than most people would ever imagine. So Moore's Lake was built by E. Lawson Moore, who was the consul general to the country of Mexico, lived in a historic home adjacent to the power plant off Bowling Street, called Windermere. And when Windermere burned by fire, it was the impetus for creating a modern Columbia Fire Department. He built Moore's Lake in the late 1880s as a recreational lake. When he died, well, when Windermere burned down, he did not rebuild the property. He sold that 100 acres into three different parcels. He sold the property to the west to the city of Columbia, which became the 1904 power plant, including this Moore's Lake. He sold the existing property to C.C. Bowling, who was the treasurer of the Tiger Hotel and the Bowling Lumberyard. Hmm. And he sold the other half to George Caleb Bingham Rollins, the son of founder of the university, Francis. You know the name.
Yeah, Rollins Street and
correct.
Rollins everything else. Yeah.
Their children married each other, okay? So you had these captains of industry and education, banking, Tiger Hotel, the father of the university, and their siblings married each other. And so now you have these two parcels right there. They also had Moore's Depot, which was the depot for the train as it followed the trail north of town. That's how far this property stretched. So at some point during the power plant, they decided to start using Moore's Lake to settle the fly ash that is that accumulates when they burn coal. I don't think anybody would probably look at that model of energy production and think it's a good idea. But now we have a lake full of fly ash that needs to be remediated because we're no longer burning coal there. I have some questions about why it's so expensive to do, but hopefully we'll get to the bottom of that. I do think it's probably good stewardship to remediate that pond.
I have a question for you. Why do you know so much about Moore's Lake and the people who have the name on that lake?
A lot of the history of that was generated during the my time on the Historic Preservation Commission. I think it's an interesting triangle. So when you look at kind of the trinity, if you will, of the Bowling property up there, the father, C.C. Bowling, lived at the old country club. That house is still there. And then the Rollinses, of course, lived on Providence Road. And so you can connect the dots between those, and you see kind of the outskirts of town, the three finest homes in the city of Columbia were all pinpointed right there.
So what's the hope? I mean, I bring this up. I thought it was interesting because on the very day that I knew we were talking about this, I saw over the weekend in the New York Times that they're having two cases in Tennessee where they are dealing with coal ash that has been dumped in water there. It's the, as it says in the article here, coal ash, the hazardous byproduct of burning coal to produce power, is a particularly insidious legacy of the nation's dependence on coal. Unlike the visible and heavily regulated airborne emissions from power plant smokestacks, coal ash is largely unseen, unless there was a major spill, and until recently, far less effectively regulated. They were concerned about how it is going to get into perhaps the drinking water of some of the places there. That's not the concern in cleaning up Moore's Lake, or is it?
I don't know if that's the concern or not, but I do know it's concerns like that that triggered additional regulation by the EPA that is prompting the remediation of that lake. When this model was conceptualized in the 40s or 50s, whenever that practice was started, I don't think anybody would look at that now and say that's probably the best environmental or engineering practice that we could have come up with.
It is going to cost, according to the notes in the preparation material for tonight's city council meeting, $7.8 million perhaps to restore that. The project is total estimated cost. So that is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, and it's shocking to me. We're talking about 90,000 cubic feet or cubic yards of coal ash. I really kind of want to figure out what is triggering that. I mean, are we hauling it out by dump trucks? And if so, how many cubic yards do we get in each dump truck? Is there a burial? Where are we hauling it to be safely moved? Are we remediating the soil so that it's clean? I have some of those questions that I want to get to.
I had a question about this. And caller, we do take calls on this program, and I'll get to your call in just a moment. And this was interesting because in one of the connections, one of the attachments to the agenda, and talking about how appropriating $1 million for ash removal as part of the restoration of Moore's Lake, that's one of the decisions to be made. And it says, in order to be in compliance with the EPA coal combustion residual, CCR rules, Columbia Water and Light needs to remediate the ash in Moore's Lake. And so it says the $1 million is going to be accomplished the following tasks. This is one of these in the nitpicking world of reading, I sometimes wonder. So point one is excavation of the ash from the pond. I understand that. Let's pull the ash out of the pond. Point two, hauling and disposing of the ash in the City of Columbia landfill. All right, haul it out to the landfill. Number three, removal and disposal of ash contaminated earth in the Columbia landfill. So you're going to take it out there, and then you have to remove and dispose of it. So
right.
It seems like you could cut out the middle part of that and take it to wherever it has to go.
Well, it's interesting, and I don't know where it has to go because, Washington County, Ameren wanted to create a coal ash landfill there, and there was a big zoning issue there just in creating an appropriate landfill space for this type of material. So, I saw that same thing. I read that level of detail as well, and those are the questions I'm going to ask tonight.
Yeah, because I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I understand that. You're going to take it out to the Columbia landfill, and then you're going to remove and dispose of it from the Columbia landfill. All right, let's go to the phone. Caller, you're on with the mayor. Good morning.
I fished that pond back in the early 60s, about 61, 62, but my mother also told me stories about in the 40s that they used to have bands out there and dance.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a real recreational asset there, and of course the VFW is right behind it, and a lot of people don't even know it's there. I've always conceptualized that at some point when we no longer need that power plant, and at some point in the next 20 or 30 years, we will need a new power plant, and it probably won't be there. It would be interesting to reorient people's perspective of that, strip off the green cooling towers and some of the latter additions to that, and you're left with a 1904 red brick building with arched windows, two-story windows, almost visible from I-70. You could really do a new access to downtown from that I-70, reorient, extend the Katy Trail north on the existing line right there, which is now the Colt Railroad, and really create a new axis to the business loop in the North Central Arts District and Columbia College.
Brian Treese is our guest. He's the mayor of Columbia. We're talking about city business, and one of the things that we're talking about is Moore's Lake. We're spending a lot of time on this for something that's going to have to be done, but I still think it's fascinating because I don't believe that it's going to be a recreation center. You're not going to fix that lake up and say, okay, now people come out here and use this. Or
no, but I also don't think that we should just dump a bunch of topsoil on it and scrape it off as if it was never there. Again, I think good stewardship and good engineering probably requires that we treat it appropriately and remediate the contaminants that man has put in there.
Something you have said, though, has piqued my interest more than Moore's Lake now, and that is 20 or 30 years from now, we will have a new power plant, and that one would be obsolete, and there won't be anything there?
I think that one's almost obsolete now. We are re-engineering that to burn biomass, and we need the coal burners are being retrofitted into something more appropriate. But at some point, we're going to have a more interconnected energy supply system. We're already using methane gas from the landfill. We've got the three GNTs that we purchased from Ameren, 7 years ago. We're exploring, sharing high voltage power line corridors with Ameren and Central Electric Cooperative. I think we're probably looking at, you know, we have a greater reliance on renewables now as mandated by our city charter and approved by voters. I think we're probably looking at, as Columbia continues to grow, needing a more diverse power supply.
Well, I mean, that's just kind of interesting to think, because I think oftentimes we think things are permanent, that they're timeless, that they're going to always be there, whether they're used the same way or not, that it will always be there. That'd be kind of interesting.
In 30 years, that power plant will be 150 years old. Uh-huh. There's going to have to be more efficient ways, and it's not going to be inexpensive to do.
Yeah. Caller, hi. You're on KFRU with the mayor.
Good morning. Could you fill me in on the building that's just east of the power plant? Is that still a home, or is it used for some commercial purpose? It looks like a beautiful building.
It's still a private home.
So private home to the east of the power plant, right, if you turn on that road there, that street. I knew that, but again, it's one of those areas you could drive by and be that very close to and never know.
Right.
I don't want to spend the whole time, hopefully, on this, but it's kind of a curiosity, and it's bringing in some of the mayor's other work on the Historic Preservation Commission. Hi, you're on KFRU.
Yes, David, this is Charlie Lee.
Yeah, Charlie.
I was wondering if the mayor was taking into consideration north of Vandiver and just east of Old Highway 63, which is range line now, there was a lake called Walcott Lake, and it was basically filled in by overflow from the lake at the power plant. And I was wondering if they were looking into that.
Interesting.
I will now, Charlie.
Huh. So where I'm trying to picture, is that still a lake there then?
Well, it's just a big hole in the ground now. At one time, it actually had a cement dam and everything, and there was quite a sizable little lake there, but overflow from the power plant lake filled it in. And I just wondered if they were taking that into consideration with this cleanup project.
Overflow in terms of them hauling, because at one point I heard they would settle the fly ash there and then either pump it out or pump out the water and then excavate that and then haul it away. Did it go there?
Well, no, they didn't. It didn't go there on purpose. It when the lake would overflow, and it did from time to time, it would carry ash with it. And it would and settled into the Walcott Lake and eventually filled that lake up.
Interesting.
I'll have to look
just
into that.
Just something to think about.
Yeah. Thanks for the perspective.
Thanks for that call. And we've got another one holding on the line for us. You're with Mayor Brian Trees. Huh?
Well, one more thing to think about. Really, in scientific terms, that ash has been there for a long time. It's inert. Now, to start digging it up, it's going to, when you're doing that, it's going to be getting into the air. It's going to be trucking it to another place and dumping it back out, and maybe a truck accident or something. I would think just a little, you know, maybe just not throw topsoil on it, but somehow seal it up and allow it to be. Because even if you take it out, if you're worried about leaching down, deep well has been doing that for almost 100 years. And so, you know, to really dissipate it, it's better off kind of like, we'll leave it alone where it is. Okay, it's a bad spot. Let's try to seal it off. It'd be a lot cheaper, too.
Thanks for the call.
You know, a whole other thing. Maybe have some scientists really look deeply in it, because, you know, you get an idea and necessarily isn't the best thing down the line. It wasn't the best thing for them to do that in the first place. Huh. So it could be you need to look deeply at this issue, because it could not be the best thing to do in the second place.
Thanks for the call. In other words, that's the let sleeping dogs lie philosophy there. I don't know. That's interesting. You may not have a choice. The EPA may not give you a choice.
We may not. And that's the same argument that's happening now at the Bridgeton landfill, a subsurface smoldering event with some radioactive waste in Bridgeton. You know, do you cap it or do you excavate it and haul it to Yucca Mountain?
You had no idea we had such smart people that talking about coal ash in Moores Lake.
I hope they all show up for the hearing tonight.
That might make your night a little bit longer, but more interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Mayor Brian Treese is our guest at News Talk 1400 KFRU. Well, you also mentioned a moment ago about the changing supply of power in this community, and that leads to another thing that you've got on the agenda, which is, I'm not sure whether it's the staff, I think it's a report, the consideration by the council, a resolution setting a public hearing, consideration and approval of the 2016 renewable energy report. Seems like that has to do with the amount of renewable energy that has been provided. And staff reports that about 6.7% of the energy for electric retail sales provided by the renewable portfolio.
That's right. And that, you know, that mandate, that expectation continues to climb. And I want to make sure that the city's well on track to meet those the public's expectations on our reliance on renewable energy. I think when everybody passed that back in, 2006 or so, we had an expectation that we would be growing our own renewable fuels, either through solar or geothermal or you know, whatever it may be, our landfill gas. And as you can see from that, we are buying most of our wind power from other sources. And, and that's fine, too. I just want to make sure that we have a plan moving forward to meet the next bump, which I think happens in, I think there's one bump in 2017 and then another bump coming up in 5 years later that we're meeting those percentages. And for a lot of, I will tell you, like the clean energy line, for example, we have an opportunity to buy that power at 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt when our voided cost to make our own power is about 7 cents a kilowatt. So it makes sense to me that, it may be cheaper to buy it and wheel it to here than it would be to continue to produce our own power. But I think having a mix of energy in that portfolio is probably the best thing.
While we're still on the subject of power, this is not an issue for tonight, because you wouldn't start a brand new council member saying, how do you want to get the high-powered transmission lines to South Columbia? But both newspapers deal with this. They deal with it with the article of Matt Pitzer coming on to the council and the Tribune, and then the Missourian runs an article kind of giving the background of the power, and their story was called Future Power Line Project Still Up in the Air, and they talking a lot about Option E. So what's the time frame? When will the nitty-gritty come down on this?
Well, I've spoken to Ameren a couple times. I think they're going to finish their analysis of that corridor sometime in May, and as I've met with the city manager and through his water and light staff on this, my triage here is that if Ameren determines that their right-of-way is available to us to either use or acquire or expand, and Option E is viable from that perspective, we need to then look at, from a city's engineering perspective, is it cost-effective? Is it feasible for us? And if the answer to both of those questions is yes, we should have another interested parties meeting to make sure that the folks that are impacted by those potential corridors are consulted and input is received. There's still a couple connections that need to be made there. The how do we connect from that Ameren corridor to the Perchy Creek substation, and then where do we locate a potential south substation, which is now anticipated as the Mill Creek substation, but I would probably prefer to put all options on the table and look at how Columbia intends to grow over the next 10, 20, 30 years and make sure that we're running these lines on the outside of town where we anticipate growth to best serve those fast-growing areas.
And that would be on the east side of town, according to the reports. You'd come down east, perhaps, and swing around. Is that as you would think now in Option E?
Well, Option E would actually be on the north side of town that would connect the Bolstead substation using Ameren's right-of-way, and we would either put our lines on their trees or expand their right-of-way and then come around the northwest part of town and drop down to that Perchy Creek substation somewhere between Midway and Stadium.
So some of what I read this morning, I thought I didn't understand the east, but west makes more sense. Interesting, because you try to get it before development there in some way, and that would affect where, you'd have to decide there if you're a developer, do I want to develop near these lines or not? And that's one of the arguments about the other options.
Correct. And, part of the equation here is part of the objective here is to have a continuous loop around the entire circumference of the city limits. And so to your point, from the east, that would be the logical way to complete that loop, is to come down through the south. I'd prefer to go further south than Grindstone, a potential Gans Road, or even further south where we share lines with Central Electric right now, and bring that around to the southern side.
Still going to have to eventually someplace, somewhere, bring the wires into town, though.
Well, we have distribution wires. What we're talking about here are large transmission towers, and those are best kept out in the countryside.
Before we're out of time, I want to bring up the topic. Later on this week, there are public sessions, I think, beginning for the Como Connector, the bus service in town.
Mm-hmm.
Your predecessor really wanted to make Como Connect work well and have that as a viable option. Where do you stand on the public transportation, the bus system in Columbia.
Look, I want it to work well too, but it shouldn't come at the expense of the folks it's inclined to serve. You know, I think in the past there has been a, well, if you buy a $5 bus pass, we'll waive the parking requirement for you downtown. That hasn't been very effective. And now you have a lot of these student apartment projects operating their own buses, you know, that really cannibalize the potential to ride on our buses. I think, I sat through the consultant's presentation at our last work session at the city council meeting, and there's a number of different routes and models, on the table here. I think one of the things that we can do to make, you know, bus riding more effective and efficient is to have a dependable line of service. I think it's something as simple as having bus stops and park benches available. You know, it frustrates me to see people sitting in the grass in front of Lucky's with their groceries, with their children, waiting on a bus to come. You know, you look at these major arterials, Broadway, Providence, et cetera, that lack just simple amenities like a shelter or a bus stop or a bus shelter, a park bench. And you know, I think there are things like that that we can do to encourage, utilization of our bus system.
Do you think that a city grows and gets to a point where bus riding, and I'm not going to take a long time trying to figure out the right words to say, but seems not to be cool, and then other cities, I mean, nobody would give a second thought to popping on a public bus. It seems to me like Columbia might be reaching a point where somehow have to change the image or change the feeling about what it means to be a bus rider. Do you think so?
I think we're probably on the cusp of that culture shift there. But, you know, as someone said during the campaign, no one's going to wait 15 minutes for a bus to come and then take an hour to go to the mall to go buy a shirt and then, you know, do the entire trip in reverse. They'll either go without or go somewhere else or wait for a ride somewhere at another time, call a cab. So now you have the advent of Uber and Lyft. And is that going to change the way people, you know, use the city bus system? I think there's probably, and the other major player here is the university, which is experiencing a parking shortage on campus as well. And how do we incorporate their constituents and stakeholders, both students and faculty, into that bus system to have something that's dependable and you know, goes where you want to go in the time frame that you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's the problem. If you want to have more frequent bus passage during all the stops, you're going to have to justify that. And right now you can't justify that with the ridership that there is. So
right. How
do you get what you want? Well, you make the investment and then hope it comes, or do you wait for it to come and maybe never make the investment?
Yeah, and I think we all want a municipal bus system that helps people get to jobs and recreational opportunities and other amenities here. I also want to include, and I think the consultant has done a good job of including the disabled population and make sure that they have access to church and city council meetings and movies on Friday nights in a way that is predictable and dependable.
Well, we're out of time, but I appreciate that. Good conversations about things that are not pressing right now on the agenda, except for the money that might go for Moore's Lake. But these are good topics.
They are. And from an energy perspective, I think it's one of for me, the infrastructure issue is one of the most basic essential functions of city government. Mm-hmm. We have to get it right. And I think it's smart to be planning ahead and looking ahead in the next 30 years, whether that's high-voltage power lines or a future power plant.
Hmm. Have a good meeting tonight, swearing in the new member, Matt Pitzer, and then they're reorganizing and getting ready for the rest of the spring
That's right. The
busy summer. Thanks, Mayor.
Thank you, David.
Mayor Brian Treese has been our guest. It's News Talk 1400 KFRU.